Today at Reader's Corner, we talk to Rick Bass, author of The Traveling Feast, On the Road and at the Table with My Heroes. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. What if you could take a road trip and visit all your heroes door to door? What if you could share a meal with them? And what if you could do it right in their own homes? Our guest today embarked on just such a pilgrimage. In his book, The Traveling Feast, On the Road and at the Table with My Heroes, author Rick Bass visited a dozen of the best literary writers of the last century, men and women whose work shaped his own. Expressing his gratitude to the language of food, Bass cooks elk for David Sedaris in the UK, shares a cheese plate with Amy Hempel in Central Park, and talks soberly with Russell Chatham about the talent-wasting effects of drink. It's a fascinating look at mentorship and writers in their own habitat, and I highly recommend it to our listeners today. Rick Bass is the author of 30 books. His work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Esquire, The Paris Review, among many other publications. He's the recipient of the Story Prize, the National Book Critics Circle Award, as well as the NEA and Guggenheim Fellowships. Rick lives in Montana's Yaak Valley, where he is a founding member of the Yaak Valley Forest Council. Rick Bass is also the visiting distinguished writer for the spring 2019 semester here at Boise State University. He'll be giving a free reading in the Lookout Room at the BSU Student Union Building on Tuesday, March 5th at 7:30 p.m. He joins us today by Skype. Rick Bass, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you, Bob.
Well, Rick, you have been so many places, the peripatetic traveler that you are. You wouldn't possibly remember this, but I certainly do because I remember my very first day, my very first weekend in Boise, in Idaho. I was interviewing for the presidency of Boise State, and I was trying to figure out what this place was all about and whether or not it would hold any interest for me being the next president. And it was 17 years ago, and as it turns out, you were appearing in the student union that day before my first of three interviews to figure out whether I could get the presidency here. And I was so impressed. I thought, oh, this place can't be too bad if they had the good sense to bring Rick Bass in here. And I went and listened to your lecture, went up afterwards and shook your hand. It's been a long time, and of course, you've done so many great things since then, but it's great to have you coming back to Boise for this visit with our writers and with our students. Thanks so much for doing that.
Oh, thanks for having me. Great to be back in touch.
So the book, The Traveling Feast, On the Road and at the Table with My Heroes, what a novel idea for a book. I mean, is there anything out there that's ever been done like this? This looks to me like the first time ever that anybody figured out a way to pay homage to mentors and do it with food and do it on the road.
I wish I had a good answer where the idea came from. I know some of the underlying frustrations that I had as a teacher led me to come up with part of it. I would go into a class and be asking my students, "Have you read so and so?" or "This your work here reminds me of this and that writer," or "This scene it might help you to read this passage by this writer." And I know younger students are not going to be as deeply read as they will be later in life, but still it was alarming to me to have these really influential writers who've been really influential to me at least, and try and find a way to share them with more than just whatever students that I happen to be teaching in any given semester. And, I was also tired of writing along the same lines. But, we as writers, as you get older, you start losing your mentors and you end up writing nice reminiscences or obituaries or elegies or whatever. And I'd gotten to where I'd done a couple of those and I didn't like it. I didn't like that they didn't get to read them. So it got me to thinking, I should go tell them in person and just make a nice meal for them. I was learning to cook and really thought that I could do okay at home. And so I wanted to share something I love, food that I believed I could do a good job with. That remained to be that was not always the case. I had never cooked outside of my home before, and that was a really naive assumption that it would be the same.
And there were a few of those writers who would rather meet you in a restaurant, I gather, rather than let you take over their kitchen.
Yeah. And, Bill Kittredge and Onyx Smith, Onyx couldn't make it. They both traveled so much, but Bill just wanted to come to the James Bar in Missoula. So we just had a burger there and Joyce Carol Oates. I don't know if it was just instinct or if she'd heard some tales ahead of time, but they made some wise choices, I think. It amazed me that, you know, we could just show up and people's doorstep and knock and come in with all these big boxes of pans and food processors and food and be asking them, where's this kept, where's that kept, digging into their cabinets and drawers and, you know, spreading flour all over the island, everywhere. Yeah, it was. I look back at it and really don't know what I was thinking, but I'm really glad that they did welcome us.
Well, you know, I got about halfway through your book and realized something that I'm sure every listener out there who picks up your book will think about. I don't think there's anyone listening who can't think of someone who had a major impact or influence in their lives and never took the time to tell them how important they were to them. I know it's happened to me, and just like you, there were two or three of them that got away, that died before I had a chance to do that. I think, if I'm not mistaken, Jim Harrison falls in that category. The great writer who was such an influence for you, I think at one point you said, Jim Harrison, who started it all for me. What does that mean to begin with? But am I correct that he died somewhere as you were in the middle of this trip?
Yeah, well, actually getting past the middle, Jim did start me on the path of fiction writing without a doubt. I did not get to cook for him, but he did know that at least. But John Graves, you know, again, knew of my appreciation for what all he'd given me, but I didn't get to cook for him. He died at the age of 90, 91, right when I was beginning the project, but he would have been the first one I visited. And it was kind of a, you know, not much talked about underlying situation, really, you know, with each of the writers. Most of them were older. Some were my age or just a little older, but it's not so much about age as, like, I think, as you were suggesting, the ever presence of mortality, no matter what one's age.
So tell us a little bit about taking your mentees along, these young writers, Aaron and Christina, to name two, who accompanied you on these trips. They're aspiring young writers in their own right. Just tell us about that decision, how that worked out, where they are now as a result of it. And yeah, your daughter, too. Your daughter, Lowry, I think, is an aspiring writer, isn't she?
Yes, she is. Yeah. And she was able to make many of the trips, and some other writers would jump on and off the bus as we moved along. But Aaron is my best nonfiction writer, and Christina, my best fiction writer. So I thought, there's no telling how many writers and students we have that will go on to success down the line. But I definitely wanted them to know these writers and to have met them before they went on into history. And again, I had no idea what it just seemed like it would be really easy when I thought of it. The execution was it was just full of challenges. It was really great fun, sometimes great stress, great conflict, great communion, great. It was an intense 4 or 5 years. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the idea of being a writer when you're young is one that so many young people have. And at one point in the earlier part of your book, you talk about your younger days trying to develop the craft of writing. And you say you were trying to become a writer trained outside the university. Or maybe you said, I am a writer who was trained outside the university. It reminds me of an interview we had just a few weeks ago with Jonathan Evison, the Northwest writer from the Seattle area. We were talking to him about his book, Lawn Boy. In fact, when I read about your early days with Eudora Welty, I thought of Jonathan's book. You guys were both lawn boys, as it turns out. And one of the things Jonathan said, he's kind of a contrarian, and he said, you know, these MFA programs, they take these kids right out of college, and they haven't been through the school of hard knocks, and they don't really know what to write about. And Jonathan never went through an MFA program, but went through the school of hard knocks for years and years. And I got to thinking, you know, MBA programs, the top MBA programs in the country, they usually won't take students who haven't been out in the real world for like 4 or 5 years after they graduate undergrad and then you can apply, and then you can get in. But they don't want kids just out of college. They want you to go get some finance experience. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on young writers and where they should get their experience. And is it always wise for a writer to jump right out of undergrad into an MFA program instead of going out there and attending the School of Hard Knocks?
Oh, it's such a tough question. And, you know, all of my adult life I've seen, you know, had friends and acquaintances wrestling with that question. And it's a really unsatisfying answer to say it depends, or, you know, the specifics are what matter. I would not have succeeded in an MFA. I'm a slow learner. I have to make the same mistake more than once. I just come to learning incrementally. And I just could not have kept up with the pace. I could have written the pages, but I could not have made, you know, that trajectory of learning that a lot of successful students in MFAs do succeed with, in staying up with that trajectory of their potential and meeting and then exceeding their potential. So, you know, I think it depends on the person's temperament and teachability or learnability. I mean, yeah, you know, I haven't heard Jonathan's argument on the issue, but I just took the only path I could take, which was slow and wandering, you know, as opposed to a more focused commitment. I mean, I worked every day when I was learning to write. I would imagine I worked as hard as I would have if I'd been in an MFA, but I had to make my mistakes. It was beneficial for me to make my mistakes on my own and then have them corrected in very slow motion, again, by that mentor-mentee relationship. You know, I would send a story to a magazine, and an editor there would send back the rejection slip, you know, form rejection, and then I'd send them another story, and they'd put their initials, you know, on the little form rejection sheet and no comment or anything. So I'd look in the masthead and see whose initials those were, and then I'd send the story to them. And the next story, they might say, thanks, not for us. And then the next story, and they'd say, thanks, but lacks depth. And so then I'd spend, you know, 6 months thinking about depth and working on depth. And then I'd send it, thanks, but lacks plot. So then I think about plot for a year or so, and you know, just little breadcrumbs coming off. And then over that slow course, developing relationships with editors who became my mentors, and just being in conversation with writers who'd influenced me, you know, not so much sending them manuscripts, very rarely that, but more just, you know, letters and conversations. So, yeah, it's a really, you know, it's a time-honored way to learn, but I also can't dispute that there's some really great fiction coming out of MFA programs. Some really great writers have MFAs. Back in the day, my favorites didn't. But who knows what, you know, if I had come of age as a writer in this generation, who my favorite writers would be. Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Rick Bass, author of The Traveling Feast, On the Road and at the Table with My Heroes. What's really impressive about your work is the range of your work. And again, I say that because I think those of us here in the Northwest who know about you, we track the fact that you're from Montana. We track the fact that you've really been an activist and deeply engaged in saving the Yaak Valley and all of that. But when you look at the range of your work, from Africa and Namibia on black rhinos to named Coulter to Texas to the Deep South, where you came from, in a sense, many, many years ago. Are you more comfortable one place than the other when it comes to the next 5 years, let's say? Obviously, you're living in the Yaak Valley, so maybe that is the highest comfort level. But I'm just wondering where writing and your life takes you next.
Home, yeah, in the Yaak is definitely my my comfort wheelhouse. I just love it there more every day and every year. Been there 32 years now, and it's just better than ever. I'm working on a novel, and the novel is set up in far northeastern British Columbia. So in my mind, that's where I am, but it really matters to me. It's really helpful to me to be home. I have a lot of interest. The grizzly population, in not just in the Yaak, but in Montana, is really under attack by the current administration. So that's taking up a huge amount of time, and logging practices are worsening pretty rapidly, with taking some either weak or abstract broad science and applying it misapplying it to the landscape up on the Kootenai National Forest. That's taking a lot of energy. I'm sure I'll be traveling a lot, but I'm trying to stay home as much as I can for reasons of affection for the place. But that said, you know, the great thing about being a writer is you can go do a story about stuff that you're passionate about. I had a great assignment last winter to spend some time with John Prine, and that was just just such a great spot of time. And, Lowry, my youngest daughter, and I went to Nashville and went around with him and asked him just anything we wanted to ask him. It was really fun.
Did that result in a piece that was published?
Yeah, it was a piece in Men's Journal magazine last spring, I think.
Yeah, John Prine has really gotten incredible attention in the last few months and in the last year or so as he has made this comeback. That's pretty cool that you got in on that.
Yeah, it was really, really very touching to witness, you know, his family production company. And yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Well, let's talk about the trip. When you look back on it all, what was the best overall experience when it comes to you connecting with the writer, your mentees, these young aspiring writers, getting able to sit there and take it all in, the meal, the dinner? I don't care whether it was in their kitchen or at some restaurant. What was the best experience and who was that with?
Well, you know, best is that kind of puts me in a bind. I mean, they were all intense and wonderful in different ways. That's such an unsatisfying answer to your question. There was a moment with John Berger in France where we were all getting ready to leave and we all sat down on a bench and he had a friend, a photographer, who was also visiting. And the photographer took a picture of us there sitting with John against his farmhouse. And we all knew what we were doing. We'd had this wonderful, lazy Sunday afternoon early dinner with John and his family, large family. And we had a large contingency there. And John was maybe 90 then. And he was just so receptive and focused and giving us what we had come for and supporting it in every way. That was quite magical. The first person we cooked for, my dear friend Doug Peacock, that was down in the desert. That was fun, driving down out of the snow and carrying this antelope shoulder in the back of the car and stopping and sticking it in the snowbanks to keep it cool on the way down there, and then getting progressively farther and further out of winter and into the desert southwest and cooking that on mesquite coals and looking up at the stars down in southern Arizona. That was the first one. Peter Matheson was intense because he was dying and was very compromised, but so supportive of the idea. But it was an early one, so we were still thinking of it as kind of not a lark, but fun. We knew it was going to be moving, but we didn't know how intense. They were all overwhelming. Some were great fun. David Sedaris was great fun as could be imagined. Lori Moore was really fun. Yeah.
How about Barry Lopez?
Barry was one of the intense ones. Not surprisingly, that was also one of the one of the more beautiful meals. So I'm really glad if I had to spend them, someone I've known and been shaped by for so long and love. You know, Barry would be. I'm really glad that we delivered for him and his partner Deborah and their daughters. It was a lovely reunion with their family. It was great fun. Also intense, really intense. I mean, Barry got the project immediately, of course, and he was really delivering the goods to Aaron. You know, this is shaking his fist at corporations and so forth, and talking about the need to be independent as an artist. It was great stuff for her to hear it at the right time. It wasn't that she questioned those things. It was just good encouragement.
You know, I have to make a confession that with 3 degrees in political science and being an ultimate policy wonk, I've spent most of my life until recently in nonfiction. And so it's not like I didn't grow up in the literary world you grew up in. And when I read your book, as you're talking about some of these folks, I'm thinking, I don't know these people. I don't know who John Berger is. I don't even know who Peacock is. I know who Matheson is. I know who Joyce Carol Oates is. Barry Lopez, I've read him, but some aren't as much headliners as others are. So since you mentioned Berger in France, maybe you should at least give us a snapshot, just briefly, you know, who is this guy?
Yeah, thank you for asking that. You know, a lot of these folks, you know, were referred to as geniuses, Jim Harrison and John, certainly, it's really hard to describe him. He wrote a lot about peasants and rural labor and, you know, all of the, you know, almost like an Irish poet in that regard, the nobility of physical work. And but he was also an incredible intellectual. He was an art critic for all of his life and very revered. He very prolific, fiction and nonfiction, very political. He donated his Booker Prize winning novel to the Black Panthers back in the civil rights era and was very engaged with Palestinian and Israeli writers. Just a magnificent old school Renaissance man in mind, a great artist, lived right beneath Mont Blanc and just this beautiful fairy tale life, you know, with cherry blossoms and apple blossoms floating in the backyard. And yeah, it was just a sweet life, incredible mind, incredible intellect, incredible generosity of spirit. He rode a motorcycle, you know, all of his life, this big old motorcycle. Went and visited him outside of Paris once when he was sick, and after we'd cooked for him, went back and saw him in Paris, and he was stoved up, and he'd parked his motorcycle in the driveway, and it had fallen over, and he couldn't lift it. You know, it wasn't strong enough. This huge motorcycle, he could ride it, but he couldn't pick it up, and it lay there on its side, he said, for a couple of days till another motorcyclist went past and saw him. Figured out what might have happened. And stranger knocked on the door. Do you need help getting your motorcycle up? And yeah. So he tottered out there, and this young stranger helped him get his bike back up. Sweet story.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Rick Bass, author of The Traveling Feast. In the book, Bass visits a dozen of his literary heroes paying homage over a home-cooked meal. Well, I'd like you to talk a little bit about Russell Chatham, and here's the angle I'd like to take on that. I mean, one of the great landscape artists of all times, but as I mentioned in my intro, he talks about the talent-wasting effects of drink, and I got to thinking, you know, Hemingway, who apparently drank when he wrote, said something at one point you know, he drank to make other people more interesting, and when you look at the four of the six Americans who won the Nobel Prize in Literature, they were all alcoholics: Faulkner, O'Neill, Hemingway, and Steinbeck. And you're not one of those, by the way, so I'm not trying to indict you, but I'm interested, Rick, in your take on these folks. I mean, I can't even imagine how you can do that, how you can be so excellent at your craft under the influence. I don't know. I just thought that would be kind of interesting to get your take on that. But if not that, at least tell us about your visit with Russell Chatham.
Yeah, to the former, I don't know what to think about it. I mean, their lives were, you know, a controlled crash, and I guess one view is that the drinking accelerated it, and whenever they could have control of the crash, you know, beauty would come out.
Yeah.
Actually, sometimes, you know, I think what's really striking is writers such as Dennis Johnson and Raymond Carver, who, you know, were in an uncontrolled crash and had talent and ambition, but did do transcendent work. They did good to great work under the influence, but after they cleaned up, they did transcendent work. And so that's I guess that's something to discuss in those conversations as well. I don't think The Old Man and the Sea was transcended. You know, I think it's really heroic work for an aging writer with the wounds that he had and physical and emotional. But I guess what we all settle on is just think how great they would have been if they could have won that battle.
Yeah, and I'm really glad you mentioned Dennis Johnson, because he was here, as you may know. Right. He spent a year here teaching, and I was privileged one time to be invited by some of my colleagues in the MFA program to have lunch with him. And I really felt, you know, out of my realm. But I just cannot tell you, and you already know this because he was on your list. And again, Dennis Johnson died recently. But the most generous man, the most interesting man, he overcame the demons, straightened out, and as you said, did this transcendent work after the fact. It's just a great example of how a writer can overcome, as I said, those demons and still be a great writer afterwards.
Yeah, great years of health and then years of lesser health, but you know, his spirit is just so immense that you can't, you know, even substance really can't tame that spirit. And he's learned how to exist with it, you know. And yeah, he is volcanic. He is his passions and appetite for life, enthusiasms are just volcanic. And he's, as they say, a force of nature. I just look at him and marvel, and look at his work and marvel, and listen to him and marvel. He doesn't do anything halfway.
Well, we were just really privileged to have him here on our campus before he left, and then about a year later he passed away. So Joyce Carol Oates is without a doubt one of the most prolific writers out there, one of the most successful. You had an evening with her. You weren't able to cook for her. And tell us about the conversation and how that night played out.
It was early June, but there was a cold front coming out of the north, and I was up in Vermont and came down to meet Joyce in her hometown where she's living in New Jersey, Hopewell. And my fiction writer, Christina, came over from her home in Philadelphia and met outside and had, you know, a lovely outside dinner. And Joyce and her husband, Charlie, were just really hospitable. And Joyce brought her editor, friend Dan Halpern, you know, legendary editor and poet and publisher. And it was just old school. You know, Christina is such a lit monk. You know, it's just like, it was really great for her to see these aging giants talking about, you know, their careers and people they'd known. And sometimes I'm not a good interviewer, and I'm not going to ask really rude and unoriginal questions, but sometimes they would still come out almost like that, and Joyce would not say yes, no. You know, it's like she was really good at communicating what she thought was a good question and what she thought was silly. It was lovely. It was really, you know, very had that feel of Eastern intellectual lit submergence, it was a gorgeous evening. We had an incident where we'd just come from McGuane's and it had this big raucous party and maybe 25, 30 people, and Christina had been there and been taking a lot of pictures, and Christina had this camera with her, and I had asked Christina to, in addition to doing a bunch of the cooking and a bunch of the logistics and a bunch of this and a bunch of that, do you mind getting photographs of these people now and again? And Tom was not camera averse, and there was some miscommunication or something. Christina didn't ask if she could take a picture before pulling out this giant camera at the table, and it was mortifying. Joyce was consummate, mannered hostess, but she did also stand her ground and say what she thought was appropriate and what wasn't. It was mortifying. But then Joyce went on past it and you know, carried the conversation while we're crashing and burning, just looking down at our toes. And it was a great evening. It was great for Christina to see that assertive confidence, I guess.
So here, let's close on one. You mentioned Eudora Welty, and I mentioned earlier that when we were talking about Jonathan Evason, that he wrote this novel called Lawn Boy, and it's semi-autographical because he was a lawn boy. And we have to have some aspiring writers listening to this show, and they need to know the lengths to which a writer will go to try to get close to a famous writer like Eudora Welty. Why don't we close by having you tell us how you tried to do that many, many years ago?
Sure. Yeah. You know, I studied geology and wildlife management in school and had not studied writing. And I was starting to write, and I was really feeling that hunger, like, what's it about? How do you do it? I need somebody to, you know, tell me about this stuff. And I thought, well, this Eudora Welty writer lives right here in the town where I'm living. I'll just go learn from her. And that she wasn't teaching, you know, I knew that, and so I thought, well, how am I going to go about this? And I intuited that probably, you know, hundreds of other young writers had gone and knocked on her door and said, hey, teach me how to write, please. And you know, maybe that even then I was thinking, okay, what can I do in exchange? What skill do I have that I can barter with? Like, I'll get a manuscript edited by Eudora, and what can I give in return? And back then, about the only two talents I had were knowing how to find oil and gas in North Alabama or lawn work. And so I went around our neighborhood putting these flyers up on everybody's door advertising my lawn services. I was working as a geologist in this downtown suit and tie kind of job and stuff. But I have this this double life where I was, you know, had a lawn service that I do on my lunch hour and weekends. And I put out bids on everybody's door. Like, I'll do this on your lawn for this amount, you know, $2-3, whatever. And I got a lot of takers, but Miss Welty didn't take me up that cutthroat price. So in the meantime, I'm on the hook, you know, cutting everybody's yard around her house, but did never penetrate that degree of intimacy where we finish mowing the lawn and go out in the backyard and sip some tea and talk about Faulkner or whatever.
Right.
I did meet her a few times subsequently through, you know, different literary stuff, and she was wonderful, great sense of humor, and gracious, and not as dignified as, you know, she had grace and elegance and a personal dignity, but she also loved irreverence, and you know, not that the two necessarily need to be separate, but sometimes we think of them that way.
Well, Rick, it has been a real joy having you on Reader's Corner, and we're just absolutely delighted that you are serving this semester as the visiting distinguished writer at Boise State, working with the MFA program, and you'll be giving a free reading in the Lookout Room at the BSU Student Union Building on Tuesday, March 5th at 7:30 p.m. And most importantly, if you want a really good kick and a good read, you got to get a copy of The Traveling Feast, On the Road and at the Table with My Heroes by Rick Bass, one of my heroes. Rick, thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much, Bob. It's great to be back in touch and great to be in Boise. Thank you so much.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.